Hi, I'm David Massover. Welcome to the Driving B2B Sales Revenue Podcast, where I'll be interviewing senior sales leaders, sales experts, and sales service providers about what else, what it takes to drive B2B sales revenue. So thanks for being here. Let's get started. Hey, welcome to the Driving B2B Sales Revenue Podcast. I'm your host, David Massover, and today we've got a great guest. Today we're talking to Justin Gray, the CEO at LeadMD. Justin, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thanks, David. Appreciate you having me.
It's a pleasure to have you. So you have a more than two decade long set of experience, a lot of success, a lot of sales, a lot of business, a lot of marketing. Along the way, I'm sure you picked up some good advice and some bad advice. Maybe you can share some of that with us. What's the single best piece of sales advice that you ever received?
Yeah, you're making me feel old. I don't know that it was
I've been around three decades, so it's not so bad.
I don't even know that it was necessarily advice. I think everyone's had someone that they've witnessed that was just awesome at sales, and it seemed, I think, probably effortless at that point. And what I was always struck by was just like the desire that this individual had to help whoever they were speaking to, like to figure out like what it is that that person needed, regardless of whether it was, you know, it served their purpose or not. And they would always serve that individual. Like, let me make this intro. Let me help you with that. Whatever the situation called for. So that's the big thing that I took away from kind of that proximity and watching this guy that, again, was just awesome at sales, was really to make it about that other person within the conversation. And that's where all the value that he created came from. And it was just a really powerful takeaway for me.
It's also kind of a play the long game kind of a perspective. Mm-hmm. It's not just, I need to close you right now, otherwise I'm not interested. It's, you know, let's just be helpful, add value, never know if something comes of it from not or not, but it's just an orientation.
My team probably hates me because I slack them this like all the time. Like they all come back around. So, you know, take the time, dive in, form the relationship. You know, maybe it's not the right time at that point, but get them something that allows us to stand out and again, provide value. And truly, I believe everyone comes back around.
Yeah. If someone adds value and you feel good about them, then maybe they come back to you when they have a need. Maybe they think of you when somebody else has a need. I mean, guess what? You're going to have a quota next month and next quarter too.
Yep.
I love it. That's great advice. What about some bad advice? I mean, there's an awful lot of bad advice floating around. What's some of the worst you ever heard?
Yeah, again, I don't know if it was necessarily framed in the form of advice, but like just the whole sales as a numbers game scenario. Like, yeah, if you do make more calls, you are going to ultimately probably get more opportunities, more customers, but that's not what yields those great customers, right? Activity and reaching out to people is kind of table stakes. But if that's what you're focused on, not going to be able to, again, provide that value that we talked about and not going to be a front runner within that position. I don't think anyone that excels at sales or business is only thinking about, I have to make 50 dials today. That may be a component just to say like, hey, what's my bar? What's my diligence going to be today? But the value proposition has to go far beyond just running through the motion. So that whole numbers game and kind of waterfall sales strategy, I've never really gravitated towards it.
It's kind of a double-edged sword, right? I mean, because if someone's not, as you mentioned, if someone's not generating activity, if they're not taking at-bats, if they're not engaging in customers, obviously, or prospects, obviously, they're not going to get somewhere. Mm-hmm. I think where it falls off the wagon is it can't just be a numbers game, but that's so much of what you see in so many sales efforts these days. Volume and velocity
I think when you put that message first, you know, that's where things really start to get kind of bastardized there. These days, like I can't even think of the last time I just picked up the phone and was like, oh yeah, that sounds really good to me. Like send me over a contract. The buying process, you know, quote unquote has changed, but people are informed. You know, they've got channels to reach out to and figure out if something's a good decision or a good solution to their problem. And they're looking for that unique piece that that sales individual can add that the rest of those channels can't. So I think you've got to keep the focus on what is that unique value proposition.
Thanks for calling. Of course, I'd like a demo. Thank God you came along. That's probably not going to happen as often
my
as you
ERP
like it to.
Software. Yeah.
Right. You know, I hadn't thought about that today. I'm glad you called. So I'm not going to make you feel old again, but you've got a very impressive background. You're the founder and CEO of a dynamic and fast-growing marketing consultancy. You've got, in a very compressed amount of time, because you're not old, you have a few other solid success stories in your background. You're an Inc. columnist. You're an investor. So a lot of perspective and a lot of experience. You and I had a conversation previously, and you asked what I think is a really powerful question that I'd like to dig into. You used COVID as an example, but it could be anything. And you made the observation that when COVID hit, a lot of energy was spent by a lot of people on questions like, how many customers are we going to lose and how much is this going to cost us? But there wasn't a whole lot of just pick up the phone and call people and ask about it. So, you know, a lack of action in the face of uncertainty. What do you think is behind all that?
I think for a long time now, we've been placing a lot of false understanding and false metric on the definition of customer relationship and customer success. And it's predominantly, you see that in the software industry, right? Like as they're measuring the health of client organizations and as they've gotten all these different tools to kind of determine how used that piece of software is, how well adopted it is internally. All those metrics have been what I would call heavily superficial. So number of users or number of things executed within that software, but it extends into services as well. It really extends into any sort of vendor-customer relationship because it's much easier to place those false metrics out there and then aim someone at measuring towards those KPIs than it is to say, pick up the phone, get to someone that matters at this customer and figure out what their key goals are and how we influence those key goals. Like that's really hard to put down to a CSR level one, right? But it's absolutely what needs to happen in order to make that big understanding of, hey, everything's hitting the fan right now. How is this going to impact our existing customer relationships? Well, the metric of how mission critical are we to those customers is a pretty good indicator of how your revenue line is going to be impacted there. Like if you're just, you know, performing kind of a nice to have, a superficial best practice type of relationship or outcome for that client, yeah, there's probably going to be some belt tightening that's going to affect you there. But if you are something that the client is leveraging to get out of that situation or to pivot their business or to implement a new solution to get through COVID specifically, that's where you can amplify that customer relationship as a result. But that understanding is, I think, the central factor to either one of those directions.
So it's almost like a corollary of your worst advice, the numbers game, right? Because in the numbers game mentality, the idea is I have to make a certain number of calls, a certain percentage of them need to move on to the next stage, a certain percentage of those, et cetera, et cetera. And that's a very different mentality than I have relationships with my clients and not every call needs to be on a spreadsheet in order to have value.
Right. I also think that asking those questions is scary. Like we almost formed, again, these false metrics of success. And again, I'm thinking predominantly through a software lens. Like, what are you trying to achieve? And how can we affect that at a level that is just above responsibility? Because we don't want to ever say that, hey, if you don't hit your revenue goal, it was our fault. Like there's all these other dimensions that could impact you there. But like the client doesn't care about those dimensions, right? Like they're buying this solution for a key business objective. And that's, you know, they have to get all these different pieces to work together. It's kind of like that age old thing with marketing software, right? Like, you know, is this going to drive more revenue? Well, it's going to drive more qualified leads. And then we don't necessarily know what sales is going to do with those leads at this point, right? Like those are items that a good customer relationship is diving into and addressing head on. To your point, via, you know, a lot of really in-depth conversations and a relationship and something that then takes those goals of the client. And, you know, that's where you can bring those into a system so that everyone is looking at the same metric and saying, what are we doing for ABC client? Oh, they wanted to achieve this. And so far we're 50% of the way there. Again, I think that's a really scary concept because there's so many, that goes so deep and you have to have such a focus on the client that notion of scale really starts to create a lot of paranoia there.
It's an interesting answer because there's two edges to the sword. One of them is about methodology and one of them is about psychology. You know, one of them is how are we going to market and what kind of relationship do we want to have with our clients and how are we measuring that and what's important to us? And mm-hmm. The other is, it can be scary to go that deep. You gave another example, which is very different, but I think it illustrates the same point, which was about, you told me about a time when you were involved in a process to develop a piece of content. And there was a lot of internal conversation about ideas and trends and concepts, but nobody said, hey, I'm going to pick up the phone and call some people who might actually be interested in this topic and ask them about it. Where do you think this psychological part comes from in people? Is that a part of culture? Is that a part of people? Have you given that some thought? Do you have some ideas about that? I'd love to hear your ideas.
I definitely think it becomes ingrained in areas of business that we typically have not aligned to the client in the past. And marketing is one of those big areas, right? Like, I think you often see marketers that are kind of standout individuals and kind of revolutionizing what, you know, the area of marketing that they're touching. They are talking about like getting on the phone with sales. They're talking about getting on calls with clients, going to see clients, participating in presentations, things of that nature. And that's giving them that level of insight that's allowing them to succeed at a really great level. But when I first got into marketing, like, we never talked to clients. Like, we were in the background, you know, creating materials for sales and creating, you know, presentations and doing advertising and things like that. And we never had that direct line. So I think a lot of people have come up with, you know, in those structures to the point where that's just their level of comfort. Like, oh, that's someone else's responsibility to reach out and maintain that relationship. So I think the nurture factor of that is something that can't be ignored. But pretty much anyone that you talk to across any discipline is right now expounding the value of talking to the client and forming that direct relationship. So I don't think you can necessarily hide behind that either.
I hope not, because it's valuable. And I think there's a lack of psychological safety for the person who's picking up the phone. But I think it hits higher in the org chart as well. You know, if I'm leading a team and I've got a decision between, I'm running a McDonald's-like organization where I tell you what you need to do and how to do it, when to flip the burger because the light went off, or I'm saying, hey, you know, I hired you because you're smart and I want you to go engage with clients or prospects or just somebody in the market and tell me what you think and take some action on that. Those are two very different leadership styles. How do you create an environment where leaders, especially not the CEO, but someone below the CEO, feels safe to allow that level of autonomy?
I do think that's cultural, right? Like, I think it's incredibly hard. Like, if that's not the environment that you naturally gravitate towards, to where you're lending that degree of autonomy, and you haven't kind of bought into the concept that, like, I'm hiring people to do things better than I'm going to do, I'm going to give them the latitude to achieve like that, I do think it's hard to shift with the same leadership there. Because either you kind of gravitate towards that or you don't. So I think that's something that's really difficult to artificially insert. But I think if you're starting out and starting a business and you're wondering, like, what is the most effective type of structure to run, I think number one, understanding what that talent looks like that can go out there and run and achieve and operate without those guardrails is incredibly important to understand for your business. And you also need to understand that that's not everyone. I think that was the hardest lesson that I've had to learn, certainly at LeadMD. I came up through the ranks and got more and more autonomy. And I just felt like, wow, everyone should have this freedom, right? That necessarily doesn't work either. You really have to find the individuals that can excel in those situations and make sure you give them that latitude to succeed. And then you need to provide other individuals a greater degree of structure. So I do think it's, you have to curate that environment based on talent in a very active way.
But it starts with understanding that it's the environment that you do want to curate. So I have a bias towards sales. That's where I spend most of my time. And you said something interesting about starting up a new company and deciding how that's going to look and feel. What I see very frequently, especially with new companies, is someone without a lot of sales experience wants to start a company because they have a great idea. Maybe they have a technical background, possibly a marketing background, or just a couple of guys had a brainstorm and they're going for it. You know, it could be any number of different things, but not necessarily from sales. And what you tend to see is a desire to cling to the safety of something like a playbook. Just map out what it is that I need to do so I can tell my people and measure it and put it into a spreadsheet and report up. So how do you balance that when it's about sales and the person who's at the top doesn't really know what is supposed to be happening in sales, but you don't really want them to constrain people to something as rigid as a playbook that's measured by artificial intelligence and you need to stay X percent to the script because we've got software watching you.
Yeah, I guess I'd be remiss if I first didn't say, I think that's a really, it's a nightmare scenario. I do think founders and key executives always need to be selling. In the rare scenarios where I've seen a core founder not have a sales bent, either their co-founder or someone very, very early in that organization is like a high-powered sales individual that has equity stake within the organization. So I think it's critical from the beginning because no one else is going to know that solution like those individuals. You know, in the early days, you're pivoting a lot as well. So if you don't have that direct feedback from the client, that's going to be really, really difficult to inform the roadmap of a solution. Like, oh, you know, the early days of LeadMD, like we were tweaking services on every client presentation. You know what I mean? Like we didn't know how we were going to bundle things together or rate per hour or what messaging was working and what wasn't. And like every single call informed that. And that was on, you know, the first 5 years of the business. It was on every prospect call that there was. And that was just absolutely invaluable to get that feedback. I think as you start to scale, so early days, like I just don't believe in playbooks. I don't think like a team of five with a sales leader is an environment that needs to scale fundamentally at that point. I think as you do start to get larger and larger and you have to rely on specialization, start to break things out in qualification or inside team, field teams, that's where a playbook can become helpful simply to onboard and provide a guide for those new individuals. But I don't see a lot of successful sales and, you know, sales contributors following a playbook. I think it's either a ramp-up tool and something that's there for context to make sure that they understand all the kind of weapons at their disposal and that they're using the things that marketing has produced and the messaging's on track and they understand buying personas and things of that nature. Like it's just it's an education tool, I think, ultimately. I have yet to see an organization thumbing through, you know, a 400-page book saying, like, what email do I send here? Or following the templates that someone builds into a sales engagement tool. Like anytime we come into an org and we talk to the reps, it's like, you guys, what are you sending out? Well, we've got these templates, but I never use those. Here's the ones that I've kind of created for myself. So I think any good, successful sales individual is going to take that as a signal. After a while, it just becomes noise.
Yeah, so it's kind of like they're training wheels. You said in this previous conversation, I love this, you said it's very rare to see the best salespeople operating from a playbook, and I think that's right. But I'm just going to ask the boneheaded, overly broad question. I mean, if sales isn't about following a playbook, what is the secret sauce? What's it all about? What makes a salesperson successful?
I mean, I think it goes back to that first fundamental concept, like, why is this person on the phone with me or taking a meeting with me? And what are they trying to accomplish? And how am I going to serve that goal? I think we've seen kind of this leapfrog, and this is something that COVID has kind of exacerbated, but this leapfrog of value that used to be, you know, far down within the customer chain. Like when you think about it, like we really start providing value to clients after they sign a contract. Okay, here's some enablement content, here's best practices, so on and so forth. Hey, we're going to help you through the onboarding process. A lot of that got moved to the front of the buying cycle due to COVID because people wanted to have that helping hand visibility and the client aligning them with like, hey, this person's here to help me in my business. So I think that was an incredibly positive outcome of COVID. And the organizations that did that really successfully were the ones that, again, really understood what their market, how they perceived them, how they could leverage that perception to step in and provide value, you know, within those early stages. And I think that's continued to carry on, even that, you know, now things have normalized a little bit and everyone's not in crisis mode. Those organizations are still focusing on like, how do we provide the most value very early on within that cycle? And that's making a big difference. So I do think it's, you know, if you're in sales, your goal is to prove your worth on every single one of those conversations. And that's really the only thing that moves people down in that buying process. If people feel like you're disconnected from who they are, you're asking questions that are irrelevant to how that buyer views you and what you can impact, that's where I think, you know, most people are disqualified or prospects go dark. They just don't see the value in that individual, how they're explaining that solution. And therefore, I think, you know, a lot of sales cycles go sideways, not even based on product or service, but on, you know, the explanation of that value proposition by the sales individual.
If you can't address the internal so what, you're just not going to get very far.
Yep.
If you're trying to build a sales organization or grow a sales organization, how do you bake that in?
I think it starts from the top, obviously. Like, those first couple sales hires are just so critical. And so, like, I've had a lot of luck in the past in hiring. For the first probably 5 years of this business, we were a Marketo implementation shop. My first sales guy, I hired from Marketo, had all of those relationships to play off of, and it was a really great hire for us at the time. So I do think there are little cheats that you can employ. Someone that is going to have customer relationships as their number one value, and that sets the tone for everyone else. Everyone else is going to see how those customer relationships are curated, you know, how they're getting intros, how they're providing value, and how they're asking for value in exchange. So I think it starts early, and you've got to indoctrinate that within your sales culture. Anything that's artificial in that environment, like, you know, again, like numbers, or hey, this is our key email or our golden pitch or whatever it happens to be, like, those are all things that can again be another arrow in the quiver, if you will, but that you can't rely on that to be the cornerstone of your sales department.
So one last question on this sales theme. I think you've articulated some really, really important points about the orientation, the mentality, the kind of drive, the kind of value that somebody needs to offer. Do you think personality fits in as a criteria when you're looking at salespeople, or do you think that's something that's maybe not as important as some people make it out to be?
Totally. We've always had a huge bent towards personality profiles and behavioral side of things, even the environmental side of things. What's their personality, and have they operated in something that looks like this organization in the past? And I would say those are the two biggest signals when you're hiring for any role, which is personality and then the environment in which they normally excel and succeed. And that, I didn't know how important that environment was in the past, but it's just absolutely critical. So I would say those are the two biggest signals that we use in every hire.
Right. So it's not just personality, but it's, you know, have you existed in a role like this? Have you been in an environment like this? Have you operated in an ecosystem like this before? Or is this going to be a jump in the deep end of the cold pool for you?
It just, maturity stage of the organization is the biggest factor there. You know, coming from large corporate environment, stepping into a startup role, that's going to be a pretty big culture shock unless that individual's done it before. So that, looking for folks that are in, you know, taking an organization from the stage that you're at to the stage you want to be is critical there.
This has been fantastic. You have a ton of experience from a lot of different perspectives. And I think it's really great the way that you've been able to encapsulate all of that into some of these core ideas about what it means to sell, what it means to build a culture, what it means to organization. I want to ask you one more question before I let you go, which is, after a couple of decades in the trenches, what's something you wish you knew when you first started out that you learned along the way?
I think probably the biggest lesson to me has been how generous people are with their time. You know, without fail. Like, if you're looking, like, this goes into mentorship, it goes into, you know, just trying to get a job, into forming relationships within, you know, the industry that you're in, or even outside of that, like, just reaching out to someone and not just asking for something, but, you know, explaining, this is what I'm trying to do, this is how I think I could benefit you. Would you be willing to give me some time to talk about X, Y, and Z? That has been extremely successful for me. And I'm always surprised and humbled by how generous people are with that time and how they're willing to have those, you know, conversations ad hoc. These are people that, you know, are in C-level roles and in executive roles. And I think that, you know, if you get someone that isn't, it's because they haven't seen that power in their own life. But most people that are at that level have experienced the same thing. And I think that's that notion of giving back and just understanding that the bar is, we're going to have a great conversation. And I'm not necessarily looking for anything other than that. So you bring some value, I'll bring some value, and we'll both walk away better for it. I never knew how predominant and how important that would be in my life in the early days.
Justin Gray, founder and CEO at LeadMD. Now that you've just told the world, or at least the world that listens to my little podcast, how generous you are with your time, where can people reach out and find you?
email's always best, jgray@leadmd.com. LinkedIn, you can search for me and find me on there. Twitter, I'm @jgraymatter. Any one of those three channels, and I'll definitely get back to you.
Fantastic. We really appreciate you sharing your time and your insights with us today. Thank you very much, Justin.
Thanks, David. Appreciate it.
You've been listening to the Driving B2B Sales Revenue Podcast with your host, me, David Massover. If you'd like to learn more about how I can help you and your sales organization accelerate growth, or if you'd like to be a guest on the show, reach out to me at davidmassover.com or find me on LinkedIn. Please rate and subscribe to the podcast to be the first to know about new episodes, and thanks for listening. Now, let's go drive some B2B sales revenue.